My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic.
Damon.
All right. I'm always curious about what I'm going to talk about. That's what's kind of neat about this deal. Congratulations. I would say congratulations on 35 years, but John Larroquette, the actor who played on, you know, the Night Court and all that, and he said that he was on the Phil Donahue show. He wasn't telling people he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was telling them that he quit drinking. And the lady in the audience congratulated him for not drinking. And he said, "Lady, congratulating an alcoholic for not drinking is like congratulating a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not getting on his horse." So, yeah, I kind of like that. I think what I want to do, there's some things that have kind of come to me recently, and I think I'm going to follow along with this, and that is the idea of one question that seems to be presented by each and every one of the steps. What I'm interested in doing is weaving my story in with this one question, and that question is that true? When I first came in, my sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004, so save you the math, that's around 13 years. So I was born in Atlanta in Georgia Baptist Hospital back in 1955. I'm 62 years old. Get all the stats out of the way. I'm one of those rare natives, although I had a guy I sponsored, and he found out I lived in East Point, so he said, "No, you're not an Atlanta native." You know, he lived right around, you know, the Brookwood Interchange there, so okay. But I went to school until about third grade down there. By the way, at 6 years old down there, I had a Pull Your Pants Down Club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members, which played a large role in my life. That's always played a role in my life there. But the whole thing about that, that says so many different things about me right there, you know. And I got, anybody here get pleasure by sneaking around?
Yeah.
You get, you know, the thing is try to not get caught, you know, the whole game of it. Used to sneak, you know, when my dad, but I came up in a family, I got no bloody excuse for being an alcoholic. Fortunately, AA just throws out the question, why? Why am I an alcoholic? Everybody in this room drank for a different reason. What's neat is we've got a solution. Isn't that neat? It's like tube socks. You know, it just, the one solution fits everybody. It doesn't matter. You see, if you want to find out why, we go to the priest or you go to the psychiatrist. And you can, and I think that's very valuable to some people. That's real important that they find out why. But for me, I found out that why is a recreational thinking question. You know, I found out that there's never been an answer to a question why in the history of mankind. You know, one person said, "Well, I think I drank because my mama had a square nipple and she potty trained me sideways." Let's say that that was the reason. Now, what am I going to do with that information? How in the world would I stay sober on that information? You know, get a different mother? I don't think that's going to work, you know? So what's beautiful about this program is we don't really care what, you know. If spending any time on it, just make up any story, it'll do. Because the solution works. And how does that solution work? Let me go a little bit more and ramp you up to this. I'm a child of the 60s. So they say if you remember the 60s, you really weren't there. I used to hitchhike down to Piedmont Park and sell joints out of my guitar case. First time I used sniff glue at 8 years old. My sister turned me on to marijuana at 10 as a step up. And then I got drunk at 12. We, you know, kind of mixed everything in the bottles, you know, from all the family liquor guys. Yeah, I got a few, "Oh, yes, yeah, there's, you know, like we thought, I thought I was brilliant. I thought I was the first one to think about that." Back in the day, you know, they do the Ritalin today. I got the paddling, you know. And they used them at the elementary school, the principal had this paddle and they decorated it, which I thought was kind of warped. But anyway, and you put your hands on, you know. And so my I got some others here with that one. So My mom, so they took me to a child psychologist, and they said he's bored. And so my parents, who didn't have a lot of money, they had, you know, were okay, and they were frugal. They were kids from the Depression era. Anybody's around that, that's an effect, you know, on your life. It really affects you if you've been raised in that environment. But in a positive way, I think, because you begin to appreciate and use what you got. But they sent me and spent a lot of money sending me to private school. And I'm one of those who had a lot of potential if I only applied myself. Anybody else here? Yeah, I got some of those. Yeah. I was a C student during that time, you know. And I really didn't appreciate it. You know, in fact, I had smoking privilege of smoking cigarettes when I was in 11th grade. In 12th grade, I got expelled from the school for smoking. They changed headmasters, and he decided I wasn't good for the school. So I graduated from Wheeler High School, and there where I just was in the between the breaks. I was there with my guitar selling my joints, you know, and all of that. I was one of these. I was bullied in this one private school I was at, though. You know, I really was. I was kind of the bottom of the rung there. But in my neighborhood where I grew up, I was one of the first kids there. We had a three-story tree hut with three levels on it, and a parking place for bicycles and the whole deal. We even had a spinner in the top to spin the bottle. We never used it, but we were real hopeful. You know? And in fact, when the builder came over and asked us where we got the wood, we said, from our parents. And when our parents asked us where we got the wood, we said, well, the builders gave it to us to keep us out of their hair. So there's a bit of being able to lie, you know, and when it became efficient, you know, that I needed to do that. A lot of that stuff. A guy, though, one of those hippies in the 60s, who asked me a very interesting question. He asked me, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? And, that for 15 years old, that was an interesting question. If I was born in Saudi Arabia, I would be Islam. If I was born in India, I'd be Hindu or Sikh or Muslim. And I remember sitting on top of Kennesaw Mountain and just trying to imagine the curve of the earth and realizing we're sitting on something quite large here. You know, I don't know if you've recognized it, but this is a pretty astonishing thing we're on here. And I wanted to find out more about it, and so I wound up majoring, actually, when I did get to college, I majored in history with a specialty India and China. I wanted to know a little bit more about what was on the other side. I want to tell you something I've observed about people who come into AA, let AA come into them, and stay. And I think we're seekers. You know, those questions mean something to us. You know, rather than notice what kind of truck you're going to know, we actually are seeking something. In fact, it's been said, Carl Jung said, did you know, that's we're seeking spirituality. You see, alcohol relieves the symptoms of alcoholism. Let me say that again. Alcohol relieves the symptoms of alcoholism. If it didn't, we wouldn't use it, right? Drugs relieve the symptoms of drug addiction. You know, I quit using drugs. The last thing I had, I smoked a joint in 83 on the way to Mardi Gras, but I'd quit several years before that just because it wasn't, you know. And when I found out, the whole circle disappeared except for a couple of people, and I found out who were the real friends and who were just users. In fact, my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama, and it was on a lake. They always wanted to live there, and I was the youngest one, so they had a room for me and everything, and I was like, town of 2,000, I'm the guy that hitchhikes down to do it. So Atlanta, so I moved down to Atlanta. I got a job working for Blue Cross Blue Shield. My title was chief inserter. It was a Phillipsburg six-station inserting machine, but I still love the title. It's a great title. But I was working in the mailroom, and I would go around and I'd see these people who had actually applied themselves. You know, there were the guys in the white shirts. They were, you know, and they had the computer cards and the racks and the whole deal. And it wasn't so much that, but I just said, you know, it might not be a bad idea to get a college education. Also, I was living down there in that area, and there's a lot of people, you know, living the way you do when you get down in that area, and just hand to mouth, and I said, I don't need to do that. And I became willing at that time, which is this really big deal, you know, in life, is I became willing to become teachable and to take the effort. And I went, I couldn't get in because of my grades to Auburn, when this was near Auburn where my parents lived. So I went to a junior college in Alabama called Alexander City State Community Junior College, which I called ACSCJCLMNOP. And it was, it's sort of an extension of Alabama high schools. But I did very well there. But I really applied myself. I did a 4.0 there and all through it. And my parents said, well, you know, you could go anywhere you want to. And I wanted higher education, so I called up Colorado, the long distance, and I just asked them. I said, what schools do you have there? And they said, Colorado and Colorado State. And I said, hold on. And I pulled a penny out of my pocket and flipped it. It was tails. And I said, Colorado State. So that was my planning for higher education. It has the tallest mountains in the 48 states. That's the reason I like it there. And the first week that I was out there, went to a meeting where they handed out refrigerators, and there was a couple of gals sitting on a couch, and I sat in and butted into the conversation. I know you guys find that hard to believe, but I the lady was right next to me. We've been married now 38 years, so I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. The other thing that we did, and I'm very grateful for, is right when as we were getting married, we said, you know, there's no reason to do this if divorce is an option. And I'm not saying anything about anybody's had a divorce or anything. I'm just saying I'm very fortunate that the kind of woman I married, that was something. And she, let me tell you what, I've benefited greatly through my drinking and my behaviors to that. She's a remarkable woman. I met her. She had burn holes in her jeans from welding. She had stains on her fingers from woodworking. And she smelled of formaldehyde because they were dissecting a corpse in her anatomy class. And I went, that's an interesting lady. You know, I mean, at Christmas, my kids buy her the tools. You know, so right now, the latest thing she's done is we went and got two nooks. Do you know what anybody here know what a nook is? It's bees. So it's her second attempt at keeping bees. And to me, those little suckers are very neat symbol of both sobriety and being one. Not, you know, I found out I'm much more like the bee or the ant than I am the leopard. You know, that gets my kill and drags it up in the tree. You know, when I really, this anonymity concept is huge. This idea that I really, no name fits me because I'm not me. I'm really just we are all, I like this guy, I just love this saying. It says, I don't have life. I am what life is doing right now. And it just it's a complete cycle. I don't have life. I am what life is doing right now. And when I take that attitude, it becomes this gratitude just becomes almost natural with that, doesn't it? So anyway, I took Chinese language for a couple of years, did all this stuff, and my wife. But then it was sort of like, where am I going with all of this? Part of that was my father-in-law was a cancer surgeon saying, where the hell are you going with all of this? I said, well, I consider myself to be a Renaissance man. He said, what the hell is that? I said, well, you know, back in the Renaissance, you studied ants for a couple of months and wrote a book on it. You're an expert, or cannonballs flying, or music, or art, you know, and I always kind of like that. And that's kind of what I've done in my career. I've specialized in being a generalist, you know, and try and know a lot of different things about a lot of different areas. And when I worked for Hewlett-Packard for one time, I was kind of between the silos. I could tell the management, this is what the accounting firm is telling you, and the programmers, this is what the, you know, HR people are looking for, and this is what the marketing people really want. And so I kind of fit that in, and it's kind of what I do even today. So I worked in a nursing home while I was in college for about a year or so. And my wife was, that girlfriend at the time, was off too in her internship at Baylor in Texas. And I got a chance to see people who had been married 75 years. People who were 105 years old, 94, 93 years old, and looking back on life. And Bill says that insanity is a lack of proportion, an inability to think straight. You know, and you look at it and you say, that's the disease is way out of proportion, isn't it? And yet, if you see people looking back on 94 years of life, you can't help but get some sense of proportion. And that carried me long through the 80s. See, I didn't drink alcoholically during the 80s. I was a guy who could leave half a beer there. I go to a party, it didn't matter whether they had beer there or not. It wasn't the focus of my attention. But you see, in The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James that Bill Wilson was reading, I've been reading it here recently, it starts like a cold car in winter. You know, it's really, you got to nibble at that book a little bit. But basically what he's saying is what are the qualities that somebody who has had a religious experience, what's a common kind of quality they have? And there's two that I really like to focus on. One of them is, you don't find God on the mountaintops, you find him in the valleys. You know? And somebody will say, you know, I just lost my job, fantastic. My wife said to me, fantastic. What do you mean fantastic? I said, the conditions are just right. The conditions are just right. You know, when I was out of ideas, that's when I came in. So, but see what happened with me, the other part that William James talked about is he said that spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience, is a shift from pessimism to optimism. Well, I went the other way. I started looking at what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with the world, what was... And I went to a bachelor party with one of the guys that worked for me and was working through a division of Equifax at the time. And they went to a belly dancing thing, and then they went to a strip club. Well, I went along, you know, camaraderie. I didn't realize this was a pull-your-pants-down club. That's what it was. And I went, you know, I'm not getting that at home. You know, my son was born in 84, my daughter in 89, so it was sometime after that. I'm not sure exactly. I love that, what happened, you know, what it was like, what happened. Whatever I think happened in the past is not what happened in the past. And by the way, just a little bit of a warning, I'm delusional about several things right now. Next year I'll be able to tell you what they are. But right now, I don't know what they are. Because last year I think I was delusional about something that I now realize I'm not so delusional about. So it just each year it's that way. So you're hearing something delusional right now, I guarantee it, and it'll come out. But a couple of weeks later after that incident, I was just tired, and I decided to go get a massage, and I didn't realize I was going to a full treatment shop, you know. And I took her up on it. And, well, what happened was, you see, Mama raised me better than that. She really did. And I started going to these places, but I also had the guilt. And I started drinking along with it, and I started drinking to cover up the guilt. And then it got to a point where one morning on the way in, I was then working for Hewlett Packard, and I was managing this data center, and there's millions of dollars of equipment, and I was going to do a presentation, and I was getting the shakes. So what did I do? I had a little in the bottle left over from the night before, so I took a drink in the morning. And you know what? That starts that whole cycle beginning to go. I wound up, somebody smelled that on my breath, you know, and one of the clients, and I denied it, of course, but then I quit. And this was in April of 2001, and I quit then, and they put me on probation, and then I just put on the afterburners. Anybody ever done that? You know, once you quit, you put on the afterburners, we show up. You know, we're very good. You know, a lot of us rate very highly on a perfectionist scale. And this was Clancy who was talking about that we really do. And yet that can become an asset as well, because we can do, you know, if we got our faculties together, we're capable of a lot of things. And so I was getting accolades and all this, and then the CEO laid off everybody in HP that was on probation as a downsizing kind of deal. And I told him, I said, you know, this time next year, I'm going to be a millionaire. And today I'm a millionaire in a, many times over in a completely different currency. See, I didn't want the car. I wanted the way I thought I would feel when I got the car. And it wasn't enough, was it? I wanted the I didn't want the house. I wanted the way I thought I would feel, and it was never enough. See, this disease is the disease of not enough. What percentage of places in the universe could you be right now without a spacesuit? How small a number is that? We're swimming in abundance. This is one of the few places in an unimaginable distance that I could stand here the way I'm dressed right now and not die. Also, each and every one of us is some of the most amazing matter in the entire universe. We're sending out probes looking for something like you. Somehow, I don't know how, but matter being able to acknowledge its own existence. And it's not happening to you, it's happening to me. But you know what? It wasn't enough. I had to change the way I felt. You know, it just wasn't enough. So I stayed sober, or dry, really, until 9/11, and I was over building a business, doing this thing over my sisters, and they were out at this German club, and I said, no, I don't want to go there, I don't want to drink, but I knew where their blackjack was. And I changed my mind about not drinking. I thought I'd have one. See, I didn't know about this. And I had three, because I don't want to drink the whole bottle, because I get pleasure by sneaking around, right? But the next morning, anybody want to guess where I was? I'm going to the liquor store. And I get there at 9 o'clock, and it doesn't open until 9:30. And I waited. King Alcohol was ruling my life. That's the symbol for me of that waiting there. And alcohol it was no longer doing things for me. It was doing things to me and controlling me. And from then, from 2001 to 2003, it was a series of quitting and starting. Now, here's one of those is that true statements. I was at the work release meeting, and one of the guys said there, when I get out of here, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. He said, what do you mean? And it just came to me right at that moment. I said, because quitting doesn't work. In fact, if I was going to write a book, when I first read the big book, I looked in there and I said, isn't there a step before one where it says quit drinking? But the first half of the first step says quitting won't work. I'm powerless over alcohol. I cannot quit. Okay, got a better plan. Plan B. I'll arrange my life in such a way so I won't have to drink. How's that sound? Second part, first step, that don't work either. My life, I cannot manage my life into a place where I won't drink. See, this isn't a program for quitters, it's a program for starters. I had to start one to be a good husband, start being a good father, start now being a good grandfather, start being a citizen of the world, as Bill talks about. It's not for quitters, don't quit. Quitting means drinking still on the list if I'm quitting. If I'm being a good father, I look on the list of things that a good father does and drinking's not on it. And there's a big difference between not on the list and quitting. So, I quit in 2003 in September, and by Thanksgiving, I'm still, you know, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. See, that's what happens. This pressure cooker goes up, you know. And I've changed my mind about drink. And I'm over in Birmingham at Thanksgiving with the family. I make an excuse that I have to come back. I get $300 that we don't really have out of the ATM. Drive all the way to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing. Don't think, la, 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 la. And I go to Mardi Gras, and I go to a massage parlor, and about 4 days later, I have 105-degree temperature. And I think I've caught something. And the fever broke and some very strange things started happening with my body. And I immediately did something. This was in December, and I went to the doctor in February. So, you know, wishful thinking, you know. Now, I'm drinking all the time now, you know. And so I got a drink to drive to go over there, so I'm not going to pee into a cup, because they'll find out that I need alcohol all the time and I don't want them to take that away. Because that's my solution. If I'm an alcoholic, alcohol is my solution. It's not my problem. But they do the swab thing and I don't have a sexually transmitted disease, you know. And it's almost like... So finally I go to a doctor in May and I tell him what's going on. And we have some really amazing people in that profession. And he looked at me very calmly and he said, oh, you're self-medicating. Boy, isn't that the truth. I feel this way. Okay, I've got to diagnose the problem, write the prescription, go fill the prescription, take the prescription, lather, rinse, repeat. you know, kind of. So I think it's an excellent example, you know, of what we do. So, and here's the deal. When I'm living based on feelings, I heard somebody tell me when I came in and said, I don't give a damn how you feel. And I thought that was cruel. And I find out it's the kindest thing I can say. See, feelings are the physiological reaction of the body to a thought. They have a lie detector. It measures this, right? And it's got this feedback loop between my mind and my feelings. This feedback going back and forth and back. I have to break it. It's almost like taking a microphone and holding it up to a speaker. Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, said something amazing. She had this journal she kept, and she said, feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith. And the idea is I harvest my feelings after I act on principles, rather than acting on my feelings, trying to change the way I feel. If I act based on these principles, the quality of the feeling I get afterwards is well worth going through that little difficulty in the beginning that, no, I don't want to. You know? I don't want to. You know, so like my seven-year-old grandson now, you know, he's meltdown because he doesn't get the pretzel. And this was back when he was three, you know. And it's like, it's a pretzel, you know. You've only had 12, you know, we're trying to help you here. But, you know, it's another great question for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do? Let's pretend. So anyway, I finally, my wife gives me an ultimatum in the letter. You know, we're living in the same house, but I've still got it, too, several pages long. Don't know what's going on with you, but we may lose the house. If we do, you may not be invited, but you need to find out. And on August the 9th of 2004, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I had my gun down to my plastic bottle of Barton vodka and my little stash of stuff that I, you know, had next to my bed. I wasn't doing any drugs or anything like that, but I had like a Hustler magazine and stuff like that. Real classy stuff. You're dealing with a classy guy here. So I decided to quit. Remember, I'm saying quit. I decided to quit. And for 2 days, I was doing the same thing I'd done for on and off. See, I quit, feel good about myself, build it all up, get the pressure built up, change my mind about not drinking, back to a fifth of vodka a day. Went like this for a year or two. And so I'm kicking on my own, still got the strange thing going on with the body. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, or 3 o'clock sometime in there, on August the 12th of 2004, I'd had my 1 hour of sleep battling the demons on the ceiling, you know. And I said the three-word prayer of an atheist, but because this time I had come to the conclusion there is no logical explanation for God, therefore you can't have God. I tried to look for God in my thoughts, couldn't find him in all the readings, couldn't find him. But I said what I now know to be the three-word prayer of an atheist, and I said deep down to my innermost self, I need help. And I look back, and I have not had the obsession to drink since that point. I didn't recognize it till later on, but I cannot recall having the obsession to drink since then. But I'll tell you this, I told my wife I had an appointment with the behavioral services for Kaiser, and I had not made the appointment. And I thought, I'm going to have to lie to her again. And I said, no, I'm not going to lie again. I said, well, what do I stop lying about? Everything. So I got my daughter off to school that morning, sat down with my wife on the couch and said, I've been a son of a bitch. Sorry, that's what the words I, and I outlined basically what I just told you. Now, I'd been smoking cigarettes for 18 years. I didn't tell her about that. Partly because her father was a cancer surgeon. She hates smoking. But that's true. She'll say, yes, she didn't know it. And pleasure by sneaking around. But I got tired of spinning those plates and keeping them up in the air. See, living an alcoholic life sucks energy out of it. This is a much easier way of living. Living my life based on principles takes a lot less energy than living my life on self-will. And the results are much better. So I called up behavior. By the way, I quit smoking that day. Congrats. But don't quit smoking. Start being healthy. That's the way I look at it. Start being healthy. It's an easier thing to do. The thing for me is I called up Kaiser to make the appointment. They said, well, we can see you on August the 31st. I said, I don't think you understand. I've been drinking a fifth of vodka a day. You know, I'm ready. And they said, we'll call you back. And I went and started getting the health problems worked out. By the way, what had happened was I had 3 fistulas between my colon and my bladder, and it was passing debris into my bladder. Now, the thing was that the doctors took a while to diagnose it because they figured that's what it had to be, except for one symptom that I was missing. I was still alive. Because that's almost like a belly wound. And my sister-in-law died from a very similar thing in diverticulitis. And in 6 months after I got sober, got that, like my plumbing reworked. I've got a zipper right here. So. But I'll tell you, it's. I went to that. I wrote down that weekend all the things I needed to do. It was about 9 pages long. My wife said, that surely is a lot to do. But it was one of those things. The guilt said, I've got things I need to do. And I wrote them down. And I went through treatment at that point. Now, when I came in, I found the first meeting I found in Cobb County. They suggested that's where I get my sponsor, was over at the Winner's Circle on Monday. And the first guy to raise his hand to the right at the first meeting I went to, he hauled dirt for a living. You know, I said, you know, I'd had a syllabus, you know, in college. You had to have this and this and this. And I just said, okay, that one off. That's fine. Well, this guy gets me out in the parking lot. He says, you believe in God? I said, I don't think so. He said, how about a power greater than yourself? No, don't think so. He said, let me get this straight. You're the most powerful thing in the universe? And I had to think about that. Comes back to that question, is that true? He said, I said, well, probably not. He said, well, at least there's hope. And he says, I only know one way to do this, and that's by the book. Thank God. And he took me through the book the way he was taken through the book. That was in August of 04. In November of 05, he gives me a call. I've gone through the steps. I've actually got a guy I'm sponsoring. And he says, hey, I'm having a heart attack. The ambulance is coming to pick me up. Don't worry about coming down. Don't worry about the hospital. I got plenty of family coming. But you know that guy you've been working with? I think you need to do this, this, and this. And I'm like, this guy's on the ball, you know? Anyway, my son hears about this, and he's there, and he wasn't at my house that often, you know, at that time. And he goes back to his apartment, and his roommate comes out and says, I got to go to the hospital. My dad just had a heart attack.
Wow.
And what's his name? Steve Davis. And it's through a lot of little things like that that I've retired as an atheist. I like to think of it as the God of my extremely limited understanding. I've just learned to not understand it. My aunt, who died at 94, 95 years old, she had her eulogy, the pastor that knew her. She was a secretary of the Methodist Diocese in Arkansas. And she came out of a class where they were talking about Israel and they had the maps and all of this. And she comes out and says, you know, pastor, says, I think we're doing this the hard way. And he says, what do you mean? She says, well, I got it boiled down to just 2 things. He said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said, reliance and obedience. You know, that works. I don't even have to know and understand the power behind these principles. If I'm reliant and obedient, the results are there. I'll tell you what happened with this. When I came in, one guy made a suggestion in one of the meetings. He said, why don't you act as if there is a God? I was out of options. This one lady, just her talk is over there, Sia, from Los Angeles, she said, when the preposterous becomes palatable. You see, it worked the other way, too. I didn't think I'd ever wind up drinking a fifth of vodka a day and doing all the things I was doing. That was preposterous. But gradually, it became palatable. And then in recovery, I had to take the preposterous, and it became palatable because I was out of options. And then when I started doing it, I started getting the result. There's some kind of crazy interconnectedness that I don't try and understand, but it's very reliable. It's very reliable. So let me talk about these, is it true? Run through this a little bit. You know, I've already run through one. Is it true that I can quit on my own? Do I have any history of that for any length of time? Is it true that my life is manageable? I can do this. Is that true? You know, I'm a pretty sane guy most of the time. Is that true? I don't believe that there's a power greater than myself. In the parking lot, I had to ask myself, is that true? Third step. It's a step about transcendence. And as Bill sees it, Bill, on page 210, wants to change one of the words in the prayer. And he says, instead of take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness, he says, take away my difficulties so that my transcendence over them. Much better word. This is instead of being the actor wanting to run the whole show, it's forever arranging the lights, the scenery, the ballet. It's playing chess with the universe. Can I play chess with the universe? Can I be in the outcomes business? I'm in business. You should be into outcomes, right? I consult in business and I tell them, no, get out of the outcomes business. Get the process right. Get the right kind of people who are running their lives on the right kind of principles, and the outcomes will take care of themselves and they'll be better. I've seen guys go after one account, going after this account and after this account, and they missed seven sweet deals and they gave away the farm on that one. You see, if I get one of the guys in my home group said, get out of the outcomes business. So that's a lot of what step three says. Get out of the outcomes business. Stop trying to manufacture. Don't work the steps. Don't work the steps. Take the steps. Let the steps do the work. See, because I see people trying to see what's the outcome of this fourth step before they ever do it. They want to know the outcome before they ever do it. Diane's nodding. She's seen. How many times have we seen that? And I go, oh no, here we go again. Just take it. It'll do the work for you. You know, my resentments are protecting me. Is that true? Aren't they really bars that are keeping me in my own prison? Making me think I'm separate from you? Fears. There's healthy fears. It's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. How can you have a healthy, evil, and corroding thread? Now, there's natural ones. I mean, we have physical fear. You get attacked by a pit bull, you know, your blood's going to start coming in from your extremities, adrenaline's going to go up, you know, and all of this. But most fear that we have today is psychological fear. And I heard outside, I love the third meeting, you know, the one before, the one during, the third meeting, the guy out in the parking lot said, every form of fear is a form of atheism. I think that's true. Yeah, I've got to believe that there's not a God big enough to handle this problem. So he's going to need some help. The fifth step. I'm not going to tell people about this stuff. It's, you know, it's too painful. Is that true? Or is carrying it around a lot more painful than getting it out? Especially to someone who's probably done 10 times worse than what you've done. And probably with a chicken. you got to realize who you're sharing with here, you know? So, six and seven. I have to work on my character defects. Is that true? When have me working on my character defects ever done anything? I think six and seven says, I'm to get out of the business of working on my character defects because that's an outcome again. You see, if I want to get the water out of a bottle, I don't try and suck the stuff out. I pour more water. If I want to get the air out of the bottle, if I want the air out of the bottle, I pour water in the bottle. If I want to get rid of my character defects, then I fill my life with a principle-centered life. If I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs, there is absolutely no time left for character defects. Now, I do have to acknowledge the difference between a character defect and a character asset. I used to think that my quick wit was a character asset. I found out a lot of people didn't agree. So that's another one of those, is it true? Is that true? 8 and 9, you know. I can never make up for what I did. Is that true? You know. I can handle, you know, I don't have to get rid, you know, I don't have to make these amends. I can, you know, I feel sorry, okay. You know. Is that true? Can you really live a good quality life carrying that around? There was a guy who came in to the jail meeting and he had been walking under an assumed name on the beaches in Florida. And he came into the jail, came in the front door, turned himself in. And he's sitting there in the meeting in waist chains and handcuffs. And he says, I'm freer right now than I was when I was walking on that beach. There's a lot more of these questions. We're coming up on the hour. But I just want you to start looking at what I have found for me is I've learned by being around you guys that I can begin to ask that question. But I'll tell you this, I don't have the answer to that question, is that true? Collectively, we do. Collectively, we know more about the truth than I know. All of these things I have are not things I came in with. I want to finish up with this. One of the big words for me in the big book is creator. Which just sounds like a funny thing for a retired atheist. But it is the realization that I didn't create me. Therefore, there is nothing to be proud of. I didn't pick my parents. I didn't pick the town I was born in. I didn't create the English language. I didn't create these concepts. Everything that I am is a gift. Kind of like evolution. Evolution says I'm a chemical reaction that's been going on for 3.5 billion years at least. How many ancestors do you have? How many of them had to do just enough of the right thing for you to be here? How can I take credit for anything? Gratitude keeps coming back in every form. And I like the phrase, wonder and awe. Earl Hightower says, marvel in the ordinary. Do you realize stars had to explode just to create the chairs you're sitting on? Each one of those chairs has got a story. It's not that the glass is half full or half empty. It's that there's such a thing as glass and such a thing as water. Glass had to have a moon that churred up the seas and the weather and everything until it ground all the rocks into sand. Somehow somebody saw the fire and saw on the bottom. They probably made little beads first to make them look good, you know. But now we have glass and water. We're sitting in a rare place in the universe where we have three forms of water on this planet. Almost nowhere do you have that. And for the alcoholic, and for me, it was not enough. And when I just acknowledge that I'm swimming in abundance, when I just acknowledge that this is it's one of the rarest possible experiences in the universe, that each and every one of us has. I don't need to augment it with alcohol or drugs. Because that'll take away from it. It doesn't add to it. And I'll finish up with this. It has to do with service. The highest rank I believe that I can reach on this planet is servant. Look at the people you admire. Mother Teresa. Abraham Lincoln. No, they don't. They don't think of Hitler as a servant. Right? And they definitely never erected a statue to a critic in the history of mankind. They shot, drawn, and quartered him, you know. But a servant. And I don't work on the quality of my life today. I find out that I'm not very good at it. I make very poor decisions. But if I try and add to the quality of your life, then I get quality by reflection. In a much higher quality than anything I could have imagined or worked in. It's much easier. I want to give this out if I can. And I will finish it up with this. If you can pass these around as far as they'll go, I'll just take them around. And I'll read it to you when we have them spread around. I'm going to tell you about a Texas school marm named Willie B., who used to go around with Joe and Charlie at the Big Book Studies, and she would do a study on the 12 and 12. And this is from her. If you need to, on WeJoy, I can tell you where it is on one of her talks, and it's worth going to hear her do the 12 and 12 book study. But hopefully we can share it around or do whatever. I wasn't sure how many to print out. But she read this at the end of one of her talks, and I just transcribed it because I loved it. It says, "The Spirit of AA." AA is a spirit. It cannot be touched, nor can it be completely understood. It is as wide as the world, yet small enough to fit snugly into the hearts and minds of man. It has brought light where only darkness dwelt. It has given hope to the hopeless and help to those who yearned in despair. It has nourished forgiveness to those who know pity. It has given strength to the weak and humility to the strong. It has spurred to higher goals those who strove for nothing. It has taught patience to the hurried and action to the lazy. To youth it has given vision, to the aged promise, to the lonely companions, to the restless rest. To the sick it has been a doctor. To the dying, it has revived the desire to live. It has no judgment to the unteachable, nor has it praise for those who learn. To the outcast, it has been a family. To the childless, it has given children. To the ignorant, wisdom. To the wise, tolerance. It has given to all man that which is most precious. It has given a love of life and a love of truth with enough left over to share with each other. Thank you for letting me share.